Lustre A&A's. I'm Matt.
I'm Richard.
We riff on movies, DVDs, TV, whatever piques our interest.
Exactly.
Before we get started, I have to apologize in advance. I've got some sort of diminished lung capacity at the moment, so if I wheeze out at the end of a sentence, that's why.
Sweet.
Yeah, nothing like prefacing your podcast with, by the way, this might suck. All right. So you sent me a couple of trailers to watch this week. One of them was Talladega Nights.
Woo! Does the world need a NASCAR movie? I mean, seriously. I mean, wasn't Days of Thunder enough to infect the world with?
Well, I'm coming at this from a few different angles. One, it's Will Ferrell as a NASCAR driver. That's the movie. I'm trying to remember the last time I thoroughly enjoyed a Will Ferrell movie.
Yeah.
I enjoyed Anchorman, but I was expecting a lot more than I got. I didn't see Old School. I understand that's pretty funny in a Will Ferrell kind of way. But, you know, the kicking and screaming, the kid soccer movie, the Bewitched.
See, I wanted to see Bewitched. I wanted to like it, but I never saw it. But I don't think I've ever enjoyed a Will Ferrell movie ever, period. I just don't like the guy that much. I find him kind of amusing, but his movies, and I know Elf was a big breakthrough. I thought Elf was a terrible movie.
No, I didn't see Elf.
And I like Jon Favreau, but it was a lazy movie, and I thought part of it with him in it was funny. It sort of reminds me of a lot of the old John Belushi stuff. John Belushi used to get all this credit, but this funny guy, and really a lot of his humor was not actually that funny, and it doesn't wear very well. So this movie here, there was actually a couple little funny scenes in the trailer, but it looked awful. And I don't know if you read the little tag where they were talking about the movie. They were saying that a legend has this movie was sold to the movie theater with the simple pitch of Will Ferrell, NASCAR. And then they bought the movie. And I'm thinking, yeah, that actually makes sense. In other words, unbelievably high concept, stupid, Will Ferrell's going to goof on it. And I'm going, well, you know, don't you want a little bit more thought into the movie than that?
Well, because making movies is a business. Yeah. And NASCAR is gigantic business.
Yeah.
And that's the other angle I approach this from. Sort of my circle of friends are huge into F1 racing, which is European Grand Prix. It's the pinnacle of car racing, basically. Tons of money, Ferrari and whatnot. And I was never a NASCAR fan before, but I'm even less of one now after being exposed to their derision of NASCAR. Which essentially, as a sport, is you accelerate and turn left.
Yeah.
Woo! And to a NASCAR, which it's such a, God help me, it's a redneck sport.
God will help you. It's boring as far as
I see. It's the most popular sport in the country.
Ugh, I don't get it at all. It's funny, in our little community here, they wanted to build a NASCAR track.
And our little community of Seattle.
Well, they're going to spend all this money on this thing, and it turns out it's not even like a NASCAR track. It's like the NASCAR B League. It's the Busch Series NASCAR. And I'm going, what is so popular about this stuff? I don't get how 200,000 people can show up and see, like you're saying, cars turn left. It makes no friggin' sense to me whatsoever.
I don't know. So the movie's going to be huge, but I'm sure I'm not gonna see it because I don't really care that much.
Yeah, same here.
The next up was Alpha Dog.
Oh yeah, you didn't get a chance to play the trailer, but I saw the scene and
I was confused.
Well, this is the movie about this kid, or there's something where this somebody gets killed, somebody gets kidnapped, and somebody ends up in South America. Don't remember the whole story. The backstory to this. No, it's not the Will Ferrell. But the backstory is the guy who directed it apparently is basing it totally on this true story. And apparently the events of the true story are still playing out. So the reason why I thought it was interesting was, first of all, he got a lot of big stars to appear in this movie. Apparently the movie is like a $10 million movie. And it has Bruce Willis in it, Sharon Stone, Justin Timberlake, Ben Foster, who's the guy who was in the clip there, who was in 6 Feet Under, and now he's going to be in the X-Men movie, the new X-Men movie. And it looks like probably it's going to be a pretty good movie all around, but it was the most interesting thing I ever saw, because at the end of the movie, the tagline says something to the effect of this happened to this guy who really existed, and he went to prison, or he went to went to Paraguay or something, and then he went to prison. And then immediately after that, it has another thing saying the events depicted in this movie, while based in reality, have been changed somewhat. And it was like this kind of weird thing where they're saying, like, they start out by saying this is entirely a true story, and they immediately, in a trailer, followed up by saying that it's not totally true. And from what I understand, the director has been deposed by the district attorney because he's been interviewing family members, and they're still on trial. And it's this most amazing mix of a real story that the movie is influencing the events of the real story. So I just thought it was interesting. I also thought it was kind of cool that the movie has a lot of interesting stars, but the preview didn't emphasize Bruce Willis, didn't emphasize Sharon Stone, didn't even emphasize Justin Timberlake. Mm-hmm. So I thought, you know, that's ballsy for a low budget movie to really sell it that way.
I had some friends I remember that were pissed at Fargo because it was like based on true events, and then it wasn't.
The famous based on a true story thing.
Anyway, they got pissed at that. Wow. And I'm thinking, it's a movie. Calm down just a little bit. Are you irritated that someone didn't get fed into a wood chipper? What exactly is your problem?
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, that does sound interesting. Sharon Stone.
Sharon
Stone.
Segues
us right into Basic Instinct 2, Risk
Addiction.
Thank you, Risk Addiction. Did you see the
Yeah, what's funny is I saw the trailer, the real trailer for the movie first, and oh my God, it looks horrible. The trailer looked horrible. Then I saw the very not for safe work promo reel that's been floating around that shows a bunch of nudity and other stuff.
And sex.
And sex. Actually, and I thought it was actually pretty well put together. I thought the beats of the movie, the beats of the sex scenes, everything else. I thought, wow, this doesn't look all that bad in complete contrast to the trailer, which is a horrible trailer. And I think part of it is because the promo trailer I saw is it's such low resolution that I can't pick anything out, and the trailer I saw was high resolution, and Sharon Stone, who is what, like 73 now, and
Well
she looks pretty good for whatever her age is, but the fact is because she's so clearly older, she comes across in this movie almost like a rapist, as opposed to like a, you know, of these poor guys that are like freaking out, as opposed to in her past movies where she's a seductress. I mean, here it just seemed like almost, I don't know, different.
Well, what's interesting to me is, you know, of course, from the first one, she was saying, oh, I didn't know they were going to do that shot, the up the dress shot.
Oh, yeah, right.
And I remember Dennis Miller had a great joke about that. He's like, you know, when you see a 500-watt light aimed up your thigh, maybe it's time for a script reread. And in this one, they're clearly, there's a very similar shot. There's a couple where she's straddling chairs. You know, they're clearly playing with that. So I found that interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was, in terms of it being, it was a hot reel.
Yeah.
I feel almost no desire to see the movie itself. If I were to see the movie, I would fast forward to the parts where there's, you know, nakedness. But the plot stringing it together, I imagine, would not hold my interest.
Yeah, I remember when I got the DVD for the first one, and this was in the earlier days of the DVDs, because when they're trying to see what it would take to get people to buy DVDs. So this one, they put it in this clear case. And then they had a ice pick in it, a plastic ice pick, which is quite possibly the stupidest thing ever to put in a DVD case. But I was happy to get it because it was a Paul Verhoeven movie, who of the great commentary tracks. The only person better than him is Werner Herzog, but his commentary tracks are so goddamn entertaining, and Basic Instinct didn't disappoint in any way. But that stupid ice pick, which I'm sure I still have, it's the dumbest thing. The only thing that I've ever had that was worse was the case for Total Recall,
because it was released at the same time.
Yeah, that's right. And they put it in that round disc that you had this unbelievably flimsy little cardboard base that would hold it, and if you destroyed the base, you're screwed because you're condemned the rest of your life having that having that round disc roll off your shelf. So fortunately, I've saved the cardboard case, but I mean, just awful. It's almost as bad as those Simpsons plastic cases that they came up with a couple years ago.
What was I going to say? Oh, the first Basic Instinct came out when I was still working at the theater, and because of where the theater was located, it was subject to power outages more frequently than normal. And a power outages completely screw a theater because it messes up their schedule because there's essentially no way to fast forward or rewind a film. It needs to play out completely. And so unless you do some magic with splicing and then you literally pick up the remains of the film and dump it on the other platter, it's a mess. But I remember when I was working at the theater, and I was fairly young. This is, I don't know, I'm 16 or 17. But I remember because of how they spliced the film together, like getting paid to be up in the projection booth to watch Basic Instinct and let the assistant manager know when the splice was coming up so that they could be in the room in case something went wrong because they had to carry the film and blah, blah, blah. But it's what a great job when you're a teenager. Getting paid to watch. Yeah. That's my fond memory of the first film.
Nice.
Okay, so moving right along here. Last week on The Daily Show, a couple of interesting things. Harrison Ford pimping Firewall.
Yeah.
And I say pimping like it's bad. I mean, of course, he's promoting Firewall. And he did it in a very faint praise kind of way. Often Daily Show interviews can go off on a tangent. This one ended up being quite a lot of that is stunt work and what he did. And
yeah.
And then he was kind of like, you know, go see the movie. You should have fun. And very much faint praise. Sort of, you can tell he knows it sucks.
And, sell the movie, dude.
Well, yeah, it reminded me when he was pimping Hollywood Homicide, which I actually saw a free screening of. And I remember as he was promoting that, he was saying, you know, who cares if he catches the bad guy? Everybody knows he's going to catch the bad guy. Does he sell the house? Because he was a detective with a realtor's license, and he was trying to get this realtor business going, and, you know, and it was kind of funny.
You know, I think that's a totally classless move, man. You either, if you are in a movie, you have an obligation. It's not just you. It's everybody else that's involved in that movie. And if you don't like it, so what? Don't undercut the movie so you can make yourself feel better. Hey, dude, turn your microphone 180 degrees. So, it seems totally, totally classless. So I didn't see the Daily Show thing, but if he is, if he's like undercutting it, if he's sort of half-hearted saying, hey, it's a light movie, you know, it should be kind of fun, you might enjoy it, that's fine. But if he's actively undercutting
it. I don't think he's actively undercutting it. I think, because realistically, I haven't seen Harrison Ford on the promotion circuit all that much.
Yeah.
That may be just his style, where he's very humble. You know, if he was out promoting Indiana Jones 4, he might do the same thing.
Yeah.
He might say, it's a fun film, we all had fun, we're all looking forward to it. Have fun seeing it. So it did not entice me to see the movie, but I was already biased against it.
Yeah.
Also, and I think this is fascinating, on The Daily Show last week, they sent one of their correspondents, Jason Jones, and I am blanking on what the topic of the story was, but I remember it was a pharmacist in Illinois decided that he did not have to provide the morning after pill. Yes. And so they go talk to him, and then they talk to the governor of Illinois. And in the middle of this interview, the correspondent, Jason Jones, says something completely out of left field and
as
satirical.
As they do on The Daily Show.
Yes, because the Daily Show, of course, is fake news. And the governor of Illinois looks off camera and says, is he serious? And you're just... And you realize the governor of Illinois has no concept of what The Daily Show is, wow. Which is fine. He's busy governing a state. But you'd think the governor's media person, media coordinator, would know enough to know that, would know enough to say this is a satirical show. And flat out, I think Jason Jones says, actually, we're going to use your words however we choose. I think he said that on camera, and then wow. So the governor starts speaking, and then they start beeping, beep. It's hysterical. I mean, in terms of a meta satirical thing, it's hysterical. But you're just left agape at how the governor's media person does not prepare him adequately for being on The Daily Show.
Well, it's funny.
How are you that out of the loop?
Well, I know, and you and I love it, and of course on the Beltway you love it, but it, you know, it's funny to hear some of the naysayers when they're talking about the hosting the Oscar telecast. They're talking about Jon Stewart got selected, and of course I think it's awesome because I know he's hosted like the Grammys before and he was awesome, but I look at this and some of them are making, which is essentially a relatively valid point, they're saying, this is supposedly like the big show on Comedy Central or anything. Well, the show gets, on average, about 1 million viewers a day. That's like nothing. That's like a tiny, tiny percentage of the viewing population. But that's their point being. And I know it's like the intelligentsia seat and everything else.
But it's the targeted audience. Well, it's the young males.
Well, I understand that. But I guess my point being is that it's entirely possible to have huge swaths of the population
of course,
that are completely oblivious.
But when you're the media person for a governor,
I don't disagree.
That's my point.
I don't disagree whatsoever. I'm just merely offering that you and I live in a bubble that the Daily Show completely dominates, and we're thinking, how could anybody be so stupid? But then I realize there's a lot of people that are pretty oblivious.
And that's fine. But when you're the media person, you need to know that. You need to prep your governor so that they don't end up looking like an idiot.
Yeah, we're in total agreement.
Which it reminded me of my favorite Daily Show moment, which I will now relate.
Okay.
It was last year, and it was the end of the show. They were teasing, like, tune in tomorrow when we do this report on whatever. And it was a segment with Samantha Bee. And she's talking to a farmer. I think he might have been a Florida orange farmer or something. And I don't remember what the topic was, but she asked him a question. And he kind of gives you that vacuous head nod where he doesn't know the answer, but he wants to look like he does. So he's nodding his head. Yep. She says, uh-huh. And do you have a problem out here in the farmland with MILFs? And he nods his head absentmindedly. And she now goes, you know, oh, you've got a MILF problem. Do you know what a MILF is? Because she's fearless about, yep. and he keeps nodding. Yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And she says, really, could you explain to the audience what a MILF is? And now that he's caught, he says, I can't. And she very, you know, patronizingly, MILF stands for mother, I'd like to, blah de blah. And it comes back, and, you know, the audience and the studio audience is laughing uproariously, and it cuts back to Stewart, who clearly had been laughing as well, and he says, why do people talk to us? Thus addressing everybody's, how do you talk to the Daily Show and not realize you're going to be made fun of? And then Stewart says, answering his own question, could it be because they want to be on the TV? Oh, and I thought that was a great moment because it so completely captured the absurdity of people not realizing they're going to be made fun of, and yet they do it anyway because they want to be on TV.
Well, you remember our former employer, Paz, that the Daily Show contacted us. Did you know that?
No.
Daily Show called us, and it was because Paz operates like the largest wildlife center in the Western U.S. And so Paz was having there was somebody who supposedly had found a Bigfoot roaming the wilds of the Northwest. And I think they wanted to talk to Paws because they want to talk to a wildlife expert as a counterpoint to this crazy guy. But they ended up, they never did the story, or they certainly didn't interview somebody from Paws. And this was before I was kind of the media person. But I remember the person who was running the wildlife center at the time, a gal named Jean Wasserman, she was going, this show wants to do us. And they say they're from, and they described it. This is in the early days, and this is before John Stewart.
Right?
And they were describing it as from, God, what was the name? What's the name of the parent company? Time Warner wants to do a story. And I was hearing, go, what, Time Warner? Well, it's some show on. And then I immediately realized it was the Daily Show. And so back then, they were clearly scared to even use the terminology. And apparently now they totally say it right out. They assume people know. They don't even want to lie. And but at the time, they were really hedging their bets. And I was like, going, oh, please. I was so excited that they might do a story, and they never did. Anyway, moving on.
Let's jump to Superman for a moment.
Superman.
What was that?
That was my, it's more like a Mighty Mouse
kind
of Superman.
That was fantastic. I hope the listening audience enjoyed that. And I hope you avail yourself of the opportunity to do it more in the future.
Superman.
Thank you. So my girlfriend had expressed a desire to see the original movie. I hadn't seen it in a long time, so we borrowed your DVD last week and watched it this week.
Dick Donner. 1970, what was that, about 78?
1978.
Yep.
I hadn't seen it in a while. I was surprised at how dated parts of it were.
Yeah.
And this is not, it's not a negative. When you film something in the 70s, you're going to get people in New York wearing 70s outfits. And,
and the look and feel of the movie feels very, it feels a little, I don't know, just, it's hard to, there's kind of a sheen to the movie, and the sets look like kind of 1970s sets, like the underground lair of Lex Luthor and some
which
of his
which I think held up just fine.
To me, I'm not saying they're good or bad. I'm just saying it reminds me, it has a feel like the sets of the Towering Inferno, the sets of other stuff. Well, it just feels like the epitome of sets before they started making things a whole lot more realistic, to tell you the truth.
It was interesting because essentially the last 30 minutes of the film is 1970s era disaster porn.
Yeah.
As I called it in my email to you. Yeah. It's the Towering Inferno. It's the Poseidon Adventure. Yeah. It's, you know, all the, you know, Airport 77 or whatever. It's all these ridiculous, overblown disaster, and it's a type, it's a genre that just it smacks you in the face with itself.
Yeah.
And I was really shocked by that watching the film again. If you take Superman out, that's essentially what it is.
Yep.
And then there's some other stuff. Like, I remembered the fact where he, you know, flew around the Earth and reversed time, which, you know,
it's been spoofed so damn many times now.
Well, it's so damn stupid.
Yep.
And
honestly, in a lot of senses, it's like, wow, if he can do that every damn time, it sort of renders everything moot. He can just kind of reverse time whenever he wants to.
Well, they set it up because, you know, it is forbidden to interfere with human affairs. That's my Marlon Brando voice.
Yeah. No better than my little Superman voice.
Anyway, so I thought that was really dumb, and there were some other. And I'm only being critical because so much of it does work.
Yeah.
Like, Christopher Reeve's performance holds up excellently, in my opinion. There's nothing dated about it. I think if you were to turn in that exact same performance today, it would still work. It would still be plausible, and you would still be engaged.
And he famously was a nobody and not considered a great actor. And that's why I think it's interesting that Bryan Singer has again picked somebody nobody's ever heard of, and I just wonder.
Well, both directors have said the big challenge isn't in finding somebody that can be Superman, isn't in finding somebody that can be Clark Kent, but in finding somebody that can convincingly do both.
Yeah.
So that was stupid, or the flying around the planet was dumb. There were a few other, the helicopter scene, there were aspects of that which were just retarded.
I don't remember what was the helicopter scene.
That was the big action when Lois Lane gets in the helicopter and there's like a cable blows up and catches the skid, and suddenly a couple of quick cuts later it's falling off the building, and that's when Superman.
Oh, that's right. The scene that I hate, I've always hated, and I know some people love it, it's romantic, is them flying and she's talking amongst herself, "Look at me. I'm with him," and
that was so awkward and so bad.
Honestly, at the time, though, it was considered like romantic and cool, and I cringe watching that, man.
And the other big thing was after the article, the initial article Lois Lane writes, and essentially, actually, that scene, you see their entirety together.
Yeah,
just about where he go, you know, "I'm 6'4", I weigh 225. And then in the article, there's all the stuff about, you know, here's the exact specifications of the galaxy I come from.
Yeah.
And then Lex Luthor reads that, "It's not unreasonable to assume that remnants of his galaxy have landed here."
Oh, Jesus.
And you're like, actually, it is unreasonable to assume that something from, you know, three galaxies over. And then there's like the Kryptonite fell in Addis Ababa. And Gene Hackman suddenly out of nowhere plucks this book from his library and finds the one meteorite which must be it. And the only reason I'm picking on this stuff is because it's almost lazy screenwriting. There's so much about the film that works story-wise and plot-wise that the stuff that doesn't work to me is so, you know, illuminated, so out there in neon flashing lights.
Well, it along with the first Batman with Michael Keaton, they're just simply the most important movies when it comes to this, because they were so unbelievably huge at a time when those movies were clearly simply not being made. And the fact that we have so many movies like this owe everything to those showing the way. I mean, they're just incredibly important.
You know, it was a seminal moment for a lot of people. It was a seminal moment for geeks and nerds and dorks of all types.
Yep.
and of course every comic book adaptation is now compared to it. And then I watched the three documentaries on the DVD and came away much more impressed with what they were able to accomplish given the pressures of
I mean, it was awful. It was one of those things where the, if I remember right, they got the Salkinds to finance it. And these are these kind of Ilya and what's the other one?
Alexander
Salkind. And it was just, it was nightmarish how they were financing it.
Well, initially it was a self-financed movie.
Yep.
Where Warner's would then just distribute it.
Yep.
They would take it and say, okay, yes, we'll distribute it. And then as things went on, Warner's actually did own a piece of the movie because the Salkinds were over budget. But it sounds like they never gave Donner a timeline to follow or a fixed budget.
And he was supposed to be filming two movies at the same time.
Had that ever been done before?
I hadn't even heard of that. And of course now that happens quite often, and he got totally screwed. They decided it was a disaster. They canned him. And then by the time the movie came out and it was considered this brilliant thing, then it was too late and they'd already hired Richard Fleischer to finish out film number two using half of Donner's footage. People don't realize that half of Superman 2 was filmed by Dick Donner. You know, it was an amazing story. And Dick Donner, the reason why I think that the commentary track, you were asking if it's any good, my recollection, I haven't heard it in a couple of years, is that he seems to have a pretty good attitude considering how painful of an experience it must have been. He just seems to think it's kind of a funny experience. Thinking, boy, that's a good attitude to take for something that clearly was
maybe
a painful experience.
Spiraled into drugs or not done anything since then, he'd be a little more bitter, but he's clearly done okay for himself. I wanted to steer left here for a minute and mention that for the first time last week, I played the game Seen It. Which is the DVD-based movie board game thing.
Developed right here in Seattle.
And you had mentioned that you would play, like one of your family members had gotten it for you for Christmas.
Yeah.
And then you'd played it. And because the way the game works, when you get the answer right, you keep going.
Yeah, my family
wasn't. You got the first roll,
it?
And that was it. And
that was it.
They never got another turn. You ran the table.
I was like, and I always get embarrassed on it because I'm really good at that. And they're like playing along, but towards the end they wanted to quit. And I'm going, no, I want to win. I want to finish. And they just want it to be over at that point. And I'm debating, should I just give up and not do it?
And so I've, some friends have had it for a while, and I've always thought, if we play that, I will dominate, much like you did.
Yeah.
And so we played it, and I failed to dominate. I was so disappointed in myself. And granted, a lot of it was. The other team is getting questions like, who played the Joker in Batman? You know, that caliber question.
Marlon Brando?
You know, meanwhile, I'm getting, you know, my team was getting ridiculously difficult questions. Like, you know, here's a scene from a John Wayne Western, black and white, that I don't remember and have never seen.
She wore a yellow ribbon. I wouldn't go into the details.
Whatever, dork. You know, name the other actor in the scene, and we're all like, "What?"
Yeah, sometimes they get pretty obscure, and they do that specifically because they know some people will get everything, so they want to even it out. I think.
And then the other team would see a scene from A Touch of Evil.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, oh, I mean, we weren't able to answer the question, but I was thinking, oh, I'm going to know it because I saw this in a film class, and I've seen the film, and I know so much about it. And then the question is, name the character's name, which is mentioned in the clip, John Quinlan. And you're just like, oh, my God.
Oh, that's not right.
Anyway, so I just wanted to mention that I played it and failed to dominate. And I think of the three games we played, my team won once.
I kind of like it. I mean, for me, I used to have this, when I was in high school and in my early 20s, I watched an enormous amount of cable television, and it got to this weird point where if there was a movie that had been filmed in the 70s or 80s, I kid you not, if it appeared on cable, I had probably seen it 10 times, and I'm a very visually oriented person, so you could literally, I could say, show me 10 seconds of any movie. I used to tell people this. 10 seconds of any movie, and I'm talking about any 10 seconds of that movie, as long as it's not the end credits. Any 10 seconds, give me about another 10 seconds, and I'll be able to tell you like three things about the movie: the name, the director, the year it came out. And I could always tell the year it came out because, you know, on our DirecTV and our old system, you know, it would show the year the movie came out and stuff. And And I could do it for anything. I mean, literally, I just, an establishing shot. So when I got to seeing it, even though it's not fully based on that, because so much of it is visual, it just pulls up that knowledge in me. So I like it. I think it's a cool little setup.
The question on the game we won was all me. The last question, which was, it basically showed scenes from Brazil.
Oh, yeah.
Like, what you know, name this movie, and then they'll show you four scenes. I'm like, you know, on the second one, I was, Brazil! And everyone's like, huh?
You bastard.
What? So I dominated when it counted the one time.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Good for you.
Next up on the list here, you have this note about Oswald the Rabbit and Al Michaels.
Oh, yeah. So I don't know if you heard, but, you know, Al Michaels, who's the great play-by-play guy for ABC, he's been there for like 15, 20 years. He was the guy that called the Do You Believe in Miracles? Yes. So he's been there for like 25 years, I guess, from Lake Placid Olympics. And he was the guy who called the famous earthquake game when they had the earthquake for the ALCS in, I think, 89. So
yeah, I remember.
So he's been there forever. He's just there prior to the Super Bowl last week. Well, anyway, so ABC doesn't have football anymore. So they don't have Monday Night Football. And
well, it's the parent company, Disney, which owns ABC
Understood.
And ESPN, they transferred Monday Night Football to
Understood,
ESPN.
But he works for ABC, and he didn't want to be there anymore because they don't have football. So he asked to go to, you know, he wanted to move to NBC, I think. So they worked out a deal with NBC, which is owned by Vivendi Universal. And they essentially traded Al Michaels. And they traded him, and part of the deal, I kid you not, one of the things they traded him for was the rights to a cartoon called Oswald the Rabbit. And I remember thinking, what? Is this some Saturday morning cartoon? And it turns out that Oswald the Rabbit was written and designed by Walt Disney in the, like, 1920s. And it looks exactly like Mickey Mouse. And it was the precursor to Mickey Mouse. So Walt Disney was hired by this one guy, which was basically Universal at the time, to do cartoons. And Walt Disney wanted to take it into a different direction, and he wanted the rights to it, and Universal said, yeah, screw you, and they fired him and said, we can have anybody do Oswald. So he adapted Oswald, and he created Mickey Mouse, because Universal thought, we can do anybody does Oswald make money. Well, of course, it was about Walt Disney, not the actual cartoon. So anyway, it's been languishing there, and apparently Disney has spent the last 75 years thinking, God, would we love to have the rights to Oswald the Rabbit back? And finally, they came up with a reason why Disney Universal needed it. It wasn't a big deal.
Well, did Vivendi Universal do anything with Oswald the Rabbit?
Not a single thing. Okay. They literally sit there owning Oswald the Rabbit. So anyway, I just thought it was funny that Al Michaels was traded for a cartoon character.
Wow.
Quite literally. Anyway, I thought that was interesting.
And then... One of the last things on my list here, Arrested Development season finale Friday night, and I saw
against the opening scenes of the Olympics.
You know, and a big F you to Fox,
absolutely,
who scheduled the last four episodes of Arrested Development as the season finale, opposite the opening ceremonies to the Olympics. And, you know, thank you to NBC, who reran the opening ceremonies at 2 a.m. that night so I could record them and make my girlfriend happy.
Yeah.
But I saw almost no promotion for the Arrested Development season finale.
I didn't see it anywhere, and I've been watching some Fox shows, and I didn't see it anywhere.
I only watched House, I think, that's also on Fox. But so that was really disappointing to me. And they were, I thought they did a really good job of wrapping things up. You know, we don't quite know if they're going to Showtime or if another network's going to pick them up or not. But if they don't, they really did a good job of creating an end point where things can continue to go on if they get picked up, or that's the end point. And I really enjoyed them. I thought they were very well done, and you know, kudos to everyone involved in such an amazing show.
Yeah.
So it's if you can find a copy of that, definitely pick it up. And those
if you
DVD,
can find it on the BitTorrent network, and
I'm not going to
it.
Advocate any sort of illegal behavior of that nature, despite its relative ease of use and ease of finding what you're looking for.
This is true.
But again, we do not advocate illegal behavior.
Well, if Fox would just sign up with iTunes, I'd download them. I got those Drawn Together and the Wonder Shows. I think it's awesome. I'd pay it. I'd buy them immediately. That's me.
So the the last thing on the list is big news from the Scarlett Johansson front.
We have actual news in our regular feature of the when will Scarlett Johansson get naked news item. And Scarlett Johansson this week, in fact, got naked. But unfortunately not on film. But they did a Vanity Fair shoot for the cover. And it was her and another hot babe, Keira Knightley, getting naked. Unfortunately, it's a cover. It's the classic artful nude. One arm goes here, one leg goes there, and you don't actually see anything, but still quite
you
nice.
Pretty much see Scarlett's posterior.
You see her whole posterior.
Which, you know, you sent me the link, and I click on it, and then I get a picture on the internet, and it's not big enough.
I found a higher res picture.
Did you?
Oh, yeah.
Can you please email
it
to
me? I'll send you
me?
The link.
Because that's a lovely looking cover.
But Scarlett Johansson, she looks awesome, except for sometimes she turns her head slightly and her head looks a little distorted. I think it looks a little distorted in this thing.
That's a shame.
But unfortunately, as you and I know, we're not looking at her head in this particular.
Hey now, be cool.
The only thing that would have made it more perfect had Rachel McAdams not freaked out at the cover shoot and gone off running, because apparently
it
was going to be.
In her defense, she hadn't been informed of the nature of the shoot.
See, I find that hard to believe, personally.
I don't.
And because it's Vanity Fair, they're always doing this stuff. And the fact that Keira Knightley and Scarlett Johansson are there, and seeing the B-roll footage, and how they're wandering around, and I mean, for clearly an hour in their bathrooms.
Yeah, but then you look at stuff like the Star Wars Vanity Fair cover. Everyone's fully clothed there.
Yeah.
So maybe she thought it was just going to be a tasteful.
Yeah.
You know, you know, never underestimate agents and publicity and backbiting and not. I don't underestimate that
sort
of behavior.
Well, I mean,
but
she's been naked in movies before, in some respect, and Scarlett Johansson hasn't for the most part. So I would have expected, for a variety of reasons, it would have been the other way. Either way, thank you, Rachel McAdams, for ruining the perfect photograph.
Hey, you know what? I'm gonna. We cannot get on our high horse and tell her she should have gotten naked.
Oh, I can be on a high horse. She
well,
damn
you,
well should have.
Yeah, complaint emails can be sent to richard@mustardayonnaise.com. Do you have anything else? I see.
I bought
some
new
DVDs.
This time I didn't go to Blockbuster. I went to my local QFC store because they have those buy two get one free and they're $10, so it's like $7. So they've re-released all the Pink Panther movies on DVD. Which kind of sucks, because first of all, there's no extras, no Blake Edwards thing. But what really sucks is they're milking the whole series, and if you look at the screen, the covers, the series is kind of a random series when you think about it. There's the first one, which isn't even Peter Sellers; it's like Alan Arkin. Then there's like the Pink Panther, A Shot in the Dark, Return of the Pink Panther. The Pink Panther Strikes Again or something. Then there's like one with this Ted Wass guy in the early 80s as his son, and it features all these outtakes. Then there's one with Roberto Benigni. But if you're looking on the, you know, on the covers, you'd hardly know they weren't all Peter Sellers ones, and it's clearly designed for people to just start grabbing them and then put them in their player and go, the hell is this? So they're sort of treating them all exactly like the same movie, which sucks. But I did get the what I consider to be the greatest one, which was, I think it's like The Return or Revenge.
Revenge.
Yeah, Revenge. That was my favorite. When I was a kid,
I haven't
I
seen
laughing
those
so hard.
Since I was a kid. And I'm a little nervous to do it to watch them again because I don't want them to lose their exalted.
Well, it's true. But I love them. I mean, I just laugh so hard. And then I got The Great Escape, which hopefully this particular copy of it doesn't suck. Apparently there's a documentary on it. I remember loving that movie when I was a kid. No commentary.
It's hard to. There's two things that now sort of inform that movie for me, and one is Chicken Run.
Yeah, that's
which
true.
Is essentially a claymation Great Escape with chickens.
Also, the Simpsons episode with when Maggie.
Maggie, sent, that's right.
And then the Ayn Rand School for Tots or whatever. And then
Eddie Izzard has a comedy bit, a routine about the Great Escape, and he's talking about. Steve McQueen is the token American, and he's dressed differently, and he's, I'll save you.
Well, you know what's funny is there's a lot of movies back then that had a huge degree of British, well, a huge degree of British participation, and invariably the British are idiots in these movies, and the Americans, and during the 60s, you know, a lot of, you know, that was sort of the mark, the American, you know, independent streak, and that was the thing to be revered. So, like, if you look at, like, The Bridge on the River Kwai and it was the stiff upper lip British people that screwed him up, and it was the William Holden that was the brash guy leaving him. And The Great Escape was a very similar movie, and the same thing applied to Stalag 17 and other movies. There's this kind of motif through those movies for whatever reason. What was the other one I got over there?
Mad Max.
Oh yeah, Mad Max. I'm so glad I got that. Like $6. Famously, I don't know if you or most people don't remember this, but you know that Mad Max 2, which is the Road Warrior in America, but considered Mad Max, it was a huge hit internationally. And the first Mad Max movie, famously, they in America, when they released it, they actually dubbed the Australian into American. So there, so
yeah,
so,
I vaguely remember that.
So this here actually pumps out and restores the original Australian soundtrack. So, and it's got some commentaries and other stuff, and I thought, well, this might be fun to listen to. I remember watching the movie, and it's really a weird movie. It's nothing great like The Road Warrior, because it's really in the immediate post-apocalyptic aftermath. It's really low budget. But I just to be able to hear what Mel Gibson's horrible supposedly Australian accent was that caused them to dub it to English. Because don't forget, Mel Gibson's American, and he only moved to Australia when he was, I think, like he was 14 or 13. And this movie came out when he was like 25. So somehow between ages of 13 or 14 and like a decade later, he had so totally lost his American accent that they needed to dub it back into, quote, American. And to me, that's the prototypical thing of the late 70s, early 80s. We were so afraid of the way other people talk that not only this was an English language movie that they redubbed into American voices. I mean, can you imagine that happening these days? I mean, it's just incredible. Anyway, so I'm excited to see that. I haven't seen it yet.
I think I've seen it once on TV a long time ago, and I don't know, the post-apocalyptic stuff kind of creeps me out, because it always makes me, suddenly I'm a lot more paranoid after watching anything like that. I'm like, oh my God, something's going to happen. But I remember, I've seen The Road Warrior. I think the Thunderdome was my favorite as a youngin.
Yeah. The Road Warrior was awesome. It was a huge hit. It was one of those things that, it was sort of a hit, and then some people talked about it. It was back in the 80s, it's like 83, and literally like 8 months later, it kind of got, it kept like putting around America, and then it started getting bigger and bigger and bigger. It ended up being this enormous hit when it was sort of a minor hit earlier. And there's a lot of people like Siskel and Ebert that were championing it, because what made that movie obviously so great was the chase scenes. And of course, what made the chase scene so great, which it's amazing how a lot of films only now they're starting to realize why, what made them so great, was the fact that they filmed all of the chase scenes never from a fixed camera. It was always from another car going the same speed. And prior to that, almost every chase scene filmed was filmed with a lot of stationary cameras with cars whizzing by, and then periodically cars on the camera, or cars or cameras on the car. And this movie here, it was all like filmed live right on there, and it just made it really intense and exciting.
I don't know. Is it going to, watching this or watching any other Mel Gibson film, is your perception of it affected by
the fact that he's a moron? No, not at all. I could care less about the whole Christian, the passion, all that other stuff. I totally temper him. If he had been a murderer or something, that'd be one thing, but I just, whatever. Tom Cruise, I'm looking forward to Mission Impossible 3, totally. And I think he's the biggest idiot, you know, on the planet. And it doesn't...
And I think I have the same thing, where it doesn't affect really my enjoyment of the movie, but it affects sort of my enjoyment of the... of feeling like I know an actor.
Yeah, that's true.
And saying like, oh, Tom Cruise, or like, you know, you grow up, or not grow up, but you become attached to certain people, like, you know, Kevin Smith, or... Jack Black.
Yep.
You know, and we feel like, you know, we were there from the beginning. We're Jack Black kicks butt, and in 5 years from now, Jack Black starts turning the Tom Cruise route.
Yeah.
I think I'll feel extremely disappointed. You know, it's none of my business if Tom Cruise chooses to be a whack job and believe in Xenu. But...
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Like, I think of George Clooney, who I just think the world, I think he's incredible, a cool dude,
puts his face
online. But man, when he was promoting Ocean's 12, him and all the other actors were in full star turn mode, and it just made me physically ill, you know, the way they were doing this. And they clearly had this banter, and it was designed.
How many buzzers does your dryer have?
I don't know.
I've heard about five so far.
So they had all this banter that was just making me ill, and I'm going, dude, you are really pressing my enjoyment of you. But, you know, I don't know. With Mel Gibson, I just sort of, I've enjoyed a lot of his movies. Some I haven't liked, but a lot of them, and I, you know, I don't even think about the other stuff at all.
Did you ever see Bird on a Wire?
Yeah, that was one I didn't enjoy. Oh,
God, I think I actually saw that on a plane.
Ugh.
And that's a perfect plane movie. I don't remember a single thing about the movie.
I remember the logo, it was a picture of a little bird with a little
target scope.
Yeah, target scope, and just the name. I hated the name.
Well, it's such typical. It's a typical Hollywood. Let's take a phrase and build a movie around it,
yeah.
Or take an easily recognizable phrase and slap it on a. I remember feeling it was very long. You were
didn't
ready for
show,
that thing to be
show
over
Willie
with.
Willie Hahn's butt in that movie.
I think they showed his butt, like, climbing up a ladder or something, yeah. And she made some comment or...
That's right.
Anyway, it was just interminably long. It was boring, and I can't believe I've summoned up the energy to even talk that much about it.
I know, Mel Gibson. He's been in some good movies. It was funny today. I was seeing an interview with Anthony Hopkins, and he was talking about filming this new movie, The World's Fastest Indian. And I had forgotten that, you know, the director of this movie, Roger Donaldson, had directed The Bounty, which I love. This was a Mel Gibson, Anthony Hopkins Mutiny on the Bounty thing from the mid-80s. And they were both, I thought, fantastic in this movie. Apparently, though, him and Anthony Hopkins and Roger Donaldson feuded like mad during this movie. And Anthony Hopkins said, well, when we did this movie, he said, hey, I came to realization that, you know what? If he asked me to do another take, I should just do it. I should just keep my mouth shut. And I should just listen to him. And when he tells me what to do, it's fine. Just do it. You'll enjoy life more if you just listen to the director and say. And it reminded me of this Malcolm in the Middle episode when what's the middle brother's name? The middle one who's such a
Malcolm.
No. I'm sorry. There's four brothers. So the middle of the except for Francis. You know, the oldest brother, I guess you could say. Of the except for Francis. Anyway, Malcolm's older brother, but not Francis. So he finally becomes this perfect student, perfect everything. He goes to this military school and he's perfect. And the guy goes, son, how did you polish your boots? I simply did exactly what you told me. You told me, pull tongue out, pull cords aside, remove lace. I did exactly as you said. I realized that when I do not think at all, how much easier life is. And then his drill sergeant goes, son, a soldier like you only comes along once in 1,000 years. So I was here when I was hearing Anthony Hopkins, he sounded just like him. It was hilarious. But anyway, I didn't realize that Roger Donaldson, you know, and him feuded. And but anyway, what reminded me of that was Mel Gibson was in it and he was fantastic. People forget that Mel Gibson has been really good in some movies. You know, but then other movies where he was pretty good and you end up looking back at him in context. Like I saw Braveheart again the other day and there was this whole hatred of gay people element that I wasn't even remotely aware of when the movie came out. And now I'm acutely aware of it, knowing he's like this uber Catholic. There was this gay like prince.
Well, the son.
And it honestly didn't occur to me how vicious it was at the time. And now I look at it in that context and go, I wonder how much this is reality, how much of this is Mel Gibson just trashing on gay.
Well, I was aware of it, that it was pretty brutal when it was happening, but I accepted it within the terms of the movie.
And now I'm wondering, well, is it, how much of this movie was based on reality? How much of that was, you know, overemphasized? So I mean, there's a little bit there, but, you know, if he does Mad Max 4, I'm there. Totally.
All right. I think, and with that brilliant insight, unless you have anything else.
Nope, nothing else.
All right. So I didn't think of anything, any clever quote to say.
We still haven't come with any of that quote. But we were going to, but what's the mustard mayonnaise quote again?
Let's get the hell out of here.
Let's get the hell out of here. Well, so I'm Richard.
You're Richard. I'm Matt.
Matt?
No, I'm Matt. You're Richard.
And I'm Richard.
You had a verbal placeholder before your name in the form of
Well, have you ever seen, you know, what's known as the worst movie of all time, worst movie title of all time It's called Rat Fink Abubu. Have you ever heard of that?
Well, no, I haven't.
It's designated as the worst movie title of all time because what the hell does that mean? And much later they realized this movie was this attempt in the 60s of being like a superhero movie with like Batman and Robin. Okay. But the titles company literally misspelled the title, and it was supposed to, they spelled Fink wrong. And then it was supposed to be Rat Pafink and Boo Boo, and they left out the ND. So they had to like, and they couldn't afford to do the title. So the movie went out as Rat Fink a Boo Boo, and it's generally considered as the worst title of all time. So when we say Richard or Matt Richard, it would be in the strong tradition of Rat Fink a Boo Boo.
Wow, that was a fantastic journey down that little side road.
Movie trivia, man. It's my bag.
All right. Okay, so I'm Matt.
And I'm Richard.
And we're done.